digitally uploaded.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I'm Matthew Sainsbury. I'm the editor of digitallydownloaded.net. And with me this week, we have Alan.
Hello.
Hello. So let's listen to a bit of music and then get stuck right into it. Welcome back, and that was a track from Foul Play. If you haven't checked it out yet, it's a really neat little brawler. You can get it on PC and the Xbox and Microsoft consoles. So let's talk about the news this week. The big bit of news was a sad bit of news. Disney Infinity has been finished up, so there won't be a Disney Infinity 4. There's a couple more bits of playsets or physical DLC miniature things for Disney Infinity 3.0, but other than that, that's it, because the studio is also being closed down, unfortunately, which means a loss of 300 odd jobs. So yeah, it's a very sad bit of news. It's a sign, I guess, or people are taking it anyway, as a sign that that whole toys interacting with games genre is on its way out, because Activision also mentioned that Skylanders is underperforming at the moment. So yeah, I think something
to also consider is whether or not the Amiibo figures are still doing well, because I feel like they're doing pretty solidly. Like, everyone keeps buying them around me, so I assume that Nintendo's not going to follow the same way, but I hope not.
Well, I think that's it. I think it's a bit of oversaturation of the market now. I mean, if you look, there's also the Lego one,
The
Lego one. Yeah, the Lego one seems to be doing all right. The one of the producers of the Lego series jumped on Twitter at the announcement of Disney and was a little bit of a dick about it, pointing out that Lego seems to be selling well. Yeah, it just seems like there was probably a limited size market for this kind of thing, given it is a very expensive way to play games. So now that there's four players in effect out there, we were probably always going to lose one of them. I must admit, I'm a bit surprised it was Disney Infinity. I thought that the strength of Disney IP would have kept that game around for a long time. But I don't know. I mean, for me, I guess the thing is, like, Disney Infinity was going all in with the Marvel figures and the Star Wars figures and all that kind of thing. But for me, the appeal was really with the kind of the old classical Disney stuff, the Mickeys, the Donald Ducks and all that stuff. And they seemed to be fairly limited in what they were doing with that back catalogue of IP. Mm-hmm. So for me, the series kind of lost a little bit of appeal. I don't know about you, whether you kind of ever gave the games a whirl, but yeah, that was my thing. It was just, they focus too much on the new IP, and I lost interest, given that I'm more of a nostalgic Disney fan.
Yeah, well, I never really got involved with any of these sorts of things. I did consider buying a couple of Amiibo when they sort of came out, because I really wanted the Yoshi Woolly World one.
But oh, yeah, of course.
It's such a huge entry fee just to get involved with that sort of thing that I just couldn't be bothered. And as I feel, most people don't have the time or the money to invest in going around looking for these figures in the first place, because some of them are pretty damn rare. And then, you know, spending money on it, like, you know, 30 bucks for a few of them is ridiculous. It's so expensive.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at them like DLC, and, you know, they end up being kind of at the high end of DLC, because, you know, if you're paying 17 bucks for a miniature or whatever in Australian for a Yoshi figurine, and that unlocks a little bit of extra content in one of the games, that's a fairly expensive bit of DLC.
It's essentially a skin for $17, which I can't justify. And it's a nice figure. They were generally quite well made, from what I've heard. But it's just sort of, it wasn't viable for so many people. And I think that's the biggest problem. But that's something that they're always going to be facing no matter what. I mean, even the actual play sets themselves, like the them, they were like $120, which is a huge amount. That's enough for two regular games at, like, the sort of reasonable price. So yeah, it was, I'm not sure there was justification for having four of these different branded toy sets for like arguing for the same market. I didn't think it was going to last for very long, and it's a bit sad that it has ended this way, but you know, it's unfortunate nature of things.
Yeah, and I guess that kind of goes back to my point about Disney focusing on the kind of the stuff that's cool with the kids. I mean, in theory, yeah. I guess it's a good idea since the kids are the ones that are probably most interested in these games as games. But, I mean, parents are only going to buy one. Let's be realistic about it. They're only going to get their kids one set of these toys. Skylanders kind of got in first, so it had an audience before Disney Infinity ever turned up. And, I mean, Lego's Lego, like,
it's going to sell no matter what, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess, once again, I just question the strategy of focusing on the new IP when if Disney made these really cool miniatures of Disney, of Mickey and Donald and all that, people would buy them whether they bought the game or not because, you know, they grew up with Disney. So I would have liked to have seen more of that, I guess. Missed opportunity, perhaps. But, exactly. Yeah, fingers crossed, of course, everybody at the studio, Avalanche, goes and gets new Avalanche. Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's Avalanche. Yeah, hopefully they all find new work. It's never good to see somebody lose their job because of closures. So fingers crossed for them all.
Definitely.
So on a different note, a very different note to what we usually talk about, I did want to kind of highlight that Assassin's Creed, the movie, has a trailer. The first proper look, I guess, at the film that we've had. And you know what? It's Assassin's Creed, so if you're not a big fan of the games, you're probably not going to think much of this trailer. But
yeah.
just in terms of it being a film, I guess, it's an interesting one. Like, I am a fan of Assassin's Creed in terms of the way it uses history. Like, I like it from that point of view. It's a bit like a Western version of Dynasty Warriors for me. I like the history side of things. So the fact they're sitting in the Spanish Inquisition is all kinds of cool. That's a really interesting period of history. And you know, is really ripe for some really kind of exciting drama and action and all that kind of stuff. So that's a tick for me. The other tick that I kind of wanted to mention that I think people are missing a little bit is the actual director of the film, a guy called Justin Kurzel, is an Aussie. Quite a young director. He hasn't done a whole lot, but he's most notable for doing the last Macbeth, which was last year, I think.
That was actually really good.
Yes, exactly. It's a really good film. And he worked with Michael Fassbender in that film as well. So they're actually working together again for the Assassin's Creed film. And that gives me a bit of hope because, yeah, that was a good combination, I felt.
Definitely.
And throw a bit more money at it. And, you know, we might just get a good-ish or interesting video game film. And if nothing else, I mean, it can't possibly be worse than an American dude with a British accent playing a Prince of Persia. I mean, that...
Yeah. I keep forgetting that movie exists.
I think we all try and purge it from our brain.
I'm a bit skeptical of this movie. When I saw it had a Kanye theme, I was a bit confused, a bit miffed, you could say. I have very little trust for all these video game movies. Ratchet and Clank burned me. It's all right, but it's not what I wanted, and it's very unfortunate. And I really don't want that to happen again with Assassin's Creed. And I don't even really like Assassin's Creed. I liked Liberation and Levita, and that was pretty much it.
I mean, Liberation's just all kinds of cool. Aveline is just...
Awesome. Aveline's the coolest. She should be in more things.
I know. She should have a real game, damn it.
I know. It's actually really upsetting as well, because playing through Syndicate for, 10 minutes, breaking it immediately, then returning it to the store was just so depressing. And then I was like, why didn't they just put Aveline in this and have it not be set with boring characters? That's so much cooler. And I just want Aveline again because she's really cool. And that story was actually kind of cool. But yeah, I'm tentatively interested, shall I say, in Assassin's Creed 2017 or whatever it's coming out.
I think it's coming out, at least in some parts of the world, on New Year's Day, which does mean that it's been positioned as the blockbuster of the year.
Oh, God. You
know, which which may or may not work in its favor. But I mean, look, if you look at it, if you go and have a look at the cast and all that, they've done a good job in terms of casting good actors. I mean, Jeremy Irons is in there.
Yeah, but he's in everything that involves any like sort of Inquisition or dragons, like or anything. It's part of who, like his entire job role is there dragons must be involved.
Yeah, I mean, he's way overdue for a good film because he is an incredible actor and hasn't done a really good one for a while. So, you know, fingers crossed he pulls one out there. Working with a director that has experience with Shakespeare is probably going to help him. Like, he is a theatrical actor. So, once again, the Justin Kurzel link might work in the favour there. And it's got a big budget. I mean, it's $125 million budgeted. So, yeah. It's obviously a big play for Ubisoft because they're actually involved with the production of this.
I think that's something that's really, really imperative as well to note is that they are actually involved with the production.
Yeah.
So whereas so many other video game movies are just sort of throwaway, like cash grabs, I do hope they're actually caring and taking effort and time and like making sure it's coherent, because so many video game movies are incoherent and it's really frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the other obvious thing is that there is no Assassin's Creed game this year, like a main Assassin's Creed game. So this is kind of it for Ubisoft, for the franchise. So, yeah.
They can't really afford to mess it up, especially not on New Year's Day sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So, yeah, I'm tentatively excited about it. The trailer is just full of, you know, slow motion. Kanye and slow motion stuff. So. Fingers crossed that's not like the entire film, but yeah.
Fingers the entire film is just Kanye just jumping across roofs.
Yeah.
Like with no context.
So, yeah, worth keeping fingers crossed over, I think is the best way to put that.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the news. I don't think there was anything else dramatic in terms of the news that happened this week. I can't think of anything anyway. Not as cool as last week. No Persona 5.
There is no Persona 5. That is very exciting.
I mean, I was kind of hoping every week we'd have some new Persona 5 Infinity news.
I want like an advent calendar for Persona news.
Ooh, a countdown. That'd be cool. Like a website that every day gives you just a little bit extra news. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Oh, can we talk about Pokemon starters as well. They've been announced. And Rowlet's awesome. Yes. Pretty cool. And Popplio is awesome too, but everyone hates him and I'm very upset.
Yeah, so which one's the owl one?
Rowlet.
Rowlet. Yeah, he's pretty cool. I like him.
He's radical. I've never been this excited for a Pokemon starter since Emerald, which is Gen 3. And I feel very old when I say that. they look pretty good. They're decently designed. Litten's adorable. Rowlet has a bow tie made out of leaves. You can't argue with that.
Like, I guess honestly, the one thing I liked about it is in the last couple of generations of Pokemon, it just looked like they were getting to the point where they were going like full, like just getting colors and throwing things against a bit of paper to come up with these designs. And they looked random and not very attractive at all. So these ones seem to be, I guess, a return to some kind of simplicity and something that looks a little more close enough to like actual animals to have that fantasy element. So I like that. I'm glad that they're doing that. I hope all the rest of the new Pokemon look like that, because that's a good start.
I want more owl-based Pokemon. There are not enough owl-based Pokemon in the entire world to satisfy me in my love of owls. Fun fact, when I was a child, I had an entire team of just owl Pokemon.
Oh, did you?
Because they made it possible in Emerald to have a bunch of those Hoot-Hoots. And those Zatus and Xanatu and stuff like that. And I love them so much.
I can one-up you there.
They weren't even very good. And that's the best bit.
Well, that's it. Me too. Like the first generation of Pokemon, there was Farfetch'd.
Here's a link.
Yes. And you could only get him by trading with like one of the characters in the game. And me being me, back then, I actually went out of my way to catch him, restart, get him again. Like I kept trading with my brothers to just keep passing off. So I ended up with like a team of 6 Farfetch'd and they weren't that great. But they were pretty cool.
They were Farfetch'd. So how are you supposed to say that?
Exactly. A team of ducks.
Yeah.
Welcome back. That was a track from Hyperdimension Neptunia VII, the JRPG that, believe it or not, I am actually still playing on and off. Already finished it at least once, twice, something like that. Anyway, it's good. I really enjoy it. If you like JRPGs, give it a go. So now to talk about if there is a polar opposite of JRPG from Compile Hearts, let's talk about Uncharted, which Alan has been playing this week, given that it has been released. So Alan, what did you think about it?
At the moment, it's very, very good. It's a bit strange in that I feel like they've taken a bit of a slower start to the entire game, which I think feels better, but it's very, very clever. That first opening sequence on the boat, oh, by the way, minor spoilers for the first like 5-10 minutes, you're on a boat and it's very, very exciting. And it's a bit reminiscent of Uncharted 2 starting, but I feel like they've been doing that since Uncharted 2 because it's a good way to get you interested in the game. Voice acting is absolutely wonderful. General acting, brilliant. The writing is pretty solid as well. And that little Easter egg when you're with Elena in your house is one of the greatest things I've ever encountered in any video game ever. I think you'll know exactly what I'm talking about when you actually do play the game. Because having seen that and then, you know, sort of freaking out, being like, no, they won't do this. They can't do this. How can they do this? And then them actually doing it was very, very fun. Very, very proud of that little moment. Very happy with Naughty Dog for that.
It does get off to a very good, interesting kind of creative start. For me, there was like three particular scenes. I will probably go into spoilers a little bit, so fast forward people about 10 minutes if you don't want to have any spoilers at all. But for me, there are three bits for that opening that I really kind of liked. Like the first is, as you say, that boat scene is actually really cool. Like, because you actually start in the water, so you're not quite sure where you are, and you think you're in like some kind of exotic place, being Uncharted and all that kind of stuff. So for you to come out of the water and for it to be so completely mundane is a nice, I guess, subversion of expectations. So that was pretty clever. I liked running around playing with the toy gun too.
That was wonderful. That was one of the things, again, I didn't expect them to do that. And then having the gunfire sounds in the background as Nate's like fantasizing, being like, yeah, I'm a big action hero, and he's just like a dad basically now, but without a child.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool. Again, it's this whole subverting expectation. It's like you go in expecting an action game and lots of climbing and all that, and for him to be running around and playing with a toy gun is just, I guess it's the kind of luxury that you have when you have as much money to throw at a game as Naughty Dog does, that you can take the time and do this kind of character development. And I don't want to really spoil the third bit, but yeah, that scene.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. The scene with him and his wife is not what I would have expected, given, you know, where that particular property now exists.
I know, exactly. Oh, I was so happy. Because that was one of the first games I ever played.
Yeah. It was a nice nod for Naughty Good Dog fans, that's for sure.
Yeah. I expected, like, Rings of Power to be starting to play or some nonsense. That game is ridiculously hard, by the way. It's awful. Don't play it.
Yeah, it's not a very good game. It does show, I guess,
they've learned
how far things have gone. Yeah, exactly. It's not the same as it once was. So is that about how far you are through it?
I think I'm in chapter 11 at this point, chapter 12. I've also put a bit of time to the multiplayer. Multiplayer is surprisingly functional. There's a lot of stuff going on there that I quite like. It retains the sort of movement of, you know, the usual game. It's actually quite a decent third-person shooter, I find. That and all the taunts are amazing. Like, you can make Nathan Drake do the Hotline Bling dance. Like, that's all I want in a video game. And you can make Sully work it. Like, come on. Like, how am I supposed to say no to that sort of game? Like, absolutely wonderful. I love those little touches. They do really care about the game, and I think they've made the right choice by having it be 60 FPS constant in multiplayer. Because in a single-player only game, I can, you know, stand a 30 FPS locked frame rate because I understand that there is a lot of stuff happening. But I do appreciate that they've taken the time, they've put the effort in to actually make the multiplayer a viable 60 FPS, just constantly smooth gameplay. I really like it. And on that topic as well, gunplay is typical Uncharted fare. It's very, very smooth. I like it. It's fun. The new fight mechanics as well, very, very interesting. Feels very, very movie-like. I don't want to use the term cinematic because I'm sick of using that term. But yeah, it feels very fluid. It's very kinetic feeling. And the climbing as well, like the animations on Nate's body as he moves around these ridiculous walls and stuff. It looks wonderful. And you can tell they've put the effort and time into study how a body moves when it's climbing that sort of way. And yeah, it's a damn impressive game. It's not going to blow your mind apart from the graphics. The graphics are incredible. But it's, you know, it's Uncharted 2 again. So can't really have a moan about that, I guess.
Sure.
And I believe Matt has a fun experience to explain. And yeah, here we go.
Yeah. So this, I swear to God, this is the last time I'm going to talk about Doom because, frankly, the game doesn't deserve my time to talk about or your time to listen to it. But I do need to talk about it as I am now playing it for review. I didn't get a chance to play it before launch because Bethesda, realizing what a turd of a game that they have coming, didn't give press copies before the game had launched. And that's always a sign of a game that the publisher has known. Yeah, no confidence in whatsoever. And they got that one right because my review will not be very complimentary unless, for some reason, the first 5 hours of the game are not reflective of the entire experience. I'm trying not to swear.
Alan, go ahead. I'm going to bleep out anything.
Alan will bleep out anything where I do, but because I don't like to swear, I want to intelligentize it. I'm trying to intellectualize what I'm going to about to say, but it basically amounts to this is the most fucking useless game. How can I put this? So I guess the thing is, right, so putting aside my previous complaints about Doom that, like, it shouldn't be called a Doom game unless it's going to be transgressive and it's going to be in the spirit of the original Doom games. So putting aside that for a minute, what it is, the experience is like a bunch of delinquent teenagers got together in a room and decided to make something that they thought was cool. But of course, being delinquent teenagers, nobody else thinks it's worth their time. It's incredibly gory, which they did promise. And they were celebrating at E3 a couple of years ago and all that, you know, like this is the gore. This is so gory. This is so cool. But it's not really cool gory. It's just gory because it's gory. It doesn't make a point with having all that gore. Like it's the, oh, they're demons and you need to kill them and, you know, that's Doom. But it's just not. Like the original Doom wanted to really push boundaries and wanted to really shock people and wanted to really be, you know, this kind of punk attitude, angsty, angry kind of game. And it was. This game is just like this multi-million dollar kind of mass-produced pile of crap that they've put together to sell copies based on what they think the most number of people would want from a Doom game. And the level design is overly linear. The combat is really poor quality. You go through some corridors like every other shooter. You'll come out into an arena and there'll be a big horde of enemies. You'll shoot those enemies. They'll run around and they'll try and get funky and all that kind of stuff. Because there's no cover mechanic, it's very fast, very fluid pace. And I'll give it that much that they wanted to recapture that arcade feel. And they have. And there isn't respawning health. You've got to pick up health packs and all that kind of stuff. So they've kept true to the original Doom as far as that goes. But for everything else, it is just the most generic first-person shooter you've probably ever played with the prettiest blood effects that you've ever seen. And none of that resonates with me at all. And they've actually tried to put like story crap in there. Like there's all these files you can pick up that have all this backstory and stuff that you end up reading simply because you're trying to latch onto something remotely interesting about the game. But like Doom doesn't work with a story.
Yes. Doom is about that. That weird guy who just rocks up and starts shooting some demons.
Well, it's meant to be visceral, right? It's meant to be this like pumping kind of fast, hardcore, gory, heavy metal kind of style rock kind of action. And none of that is in this.
Like, sounds none. Like your favorite game in the world. So you're a contender?
You might as well be playing like Call of Duty with a chainsaw. And it's just not right. So Bethesda should be absolutely ashamed for what they've greenlit with this one. They've ruined the Doom franchise with this game, as far as I'm concerned.
So game of the year every year for 10 years. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad to hear. That's a digitally uploaded scoop.
The only thing that's worse is like Homefront's coming out in a couple of weeks, and that's probably going to be even worse. And I'm just like, this shooter genre is just going to hell. Like, ooh. Maybe Doom Guy can save it.
It's actually a metaphor.
It's just ridiculous. It's like, get some original ideas, guys. Like, with all credit to, at least the last Call of Duty actually tried to do something different. Like,
Black Ops 3 is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I didn't play it for very long, and I sold it to my brother-in-law, but, like, it's a decent game. There's a lot of
content. It had all these suit effects and all that kind of stuff, and it almost felt like a little bit like a Mass Effect in places, you know? It had alternative ways to tackle combat and all that kind of stuff, and it was, you know, everybody likes to crap on Call of Duty for being Call of Duty, but it's nowhere near as generic as some of these games that are being produced now.
I mean, have you seen the downvotes on the new Call of Duty trailer? It's over a million.
I saw that.
Awful. I can't believe it, because it doesn't look that bad.
I think that's Activision. The kind of community that Activision has cultivated for the Call of Duty series over the years is probably not the most pleasant one out there. Shouldn't say that, because now if anybody's listening to the podcast...
You're basically already going to be DDoSed.
Yeah, but, you know, it's always struck me as having a fairly toxic community to contend with. You know, people always have issues with what they get from, you know, random matchups in Call of Duty. So Activision probably should have been a little bit more careful about the community that they were building, because then when they try and do something that's a little bit different, like they have with this new upcoming Call of Duty.
I wouldn't say it's different. I'd say it's slight evolution on the same thing that they've been doing for the last four games, pretty much.
Relatively different. You know, at least they're trying... I mean, space is potentially... a very different direction to take the series. I know it's had a couple of space moments in the past, but it looks like this one's going to have an extended air kind of couple of levels or whatever in space. And that could potentially be interesting, depending on how they handle it.
Battlefield 1 still gets my vote. I'm just going to say that and leave it at that.
Yeah, let's save my issues with Battlefield 1 for another day, I think.
Okay.
I've had enough ranting about Doom. Anyway, I promise no more comments about Doom on the podcast. And the review that I write for it for the website will be the last time I mention that on the site too, because I'll put this behind me. I will move on to happier games. Welcome back. That was a track from Shantae. After the Doom rant, I needed a little cheering up. So that's the music we picked. All right. So given that I have been playing that game and it's themed after horror, we thought we'd have a chat about horror games, good ones that we've been playing or have played over the years. I guess the other reason that I want to mention or bring that up this week is because about a week ago, The Park was released on the PlayStation 4, which is a very good horror game. And I think that one I will start talking about. So The Park is a narrative-heavy horror game. There's not really any kind of physical threat to your character at any point. It's more about experience and the story. And the way it does the story is what's particularly, scary. It's all set inside a theme park. And once you do that, once you play this game, the next time you go to Disneyland or Luna Park, you may not see it the same way.
I was going to say, theme parks already horrify me because of clowns. So
yes.
Yeah, I might have to skip this one just out of safety.
Well, it's actually really well done. The way that the developers have understood how to direct your attention in certain ways and then hit you with something scary that's not where you might expect it is really interesting stuff. So to give you an example, the first ride, because to experience the story, you actually get on all the rides in the theme park and they all go to hell and stuff. So the first ride that you do is one of those kind of boat rides through a story thing, like It's a Small World, you know, the classic.
Thing that terrifies me. Yeah, good.
Yeah, exactly. So you get on the boat and it's a swan boat and it's all looking very nice. And you go into the cave and it's telling this story about Hansel and Gretel. And as it's doing that, there's some lights that pop up on the wall with silhouettes, kind of, you know, visualizing the story. And that's, you know, you're paying attention to those and that's good. And then you'll turn your character's head to look, you know, in a different direction slightly because maybe something sort of catches your attention. And there's like this creepy ass, like costume squirrel thing looking at you with these beady red eyes.
And it's
just staring at you. And it's like, holy crap. And if you were just paying attention to the story bit, you'd miss that, except for the fact that like there's this noise that's going on around you that doesn't feel right. So it has this great ability to really make you like itchy to kind of give you the sense itchy. That there's always
could
something.
Would you say that it allows you to feel a bit itchy tasty?
Yeah, a bit like it. So yeah, I mean, that's really good. And I mean, the way the story finishes with Hansel and Gretel is like all kinds of creepy. So in the real Hansel and Gretel, obviously, once they throw the witch into the fire, they kind of escape. And I'm allowed to spoil it. It's a very old story.
Not doing spoilers.
But for this game, there's like one extra scene that's added on the end. And it's done in such a way that I was questioning whether my memory of the story was right. So at the end, it's like that. There's this throwaway comment that, and now that they're hungry, so they eat the witch.
And it does sound realistic enough.
Did that actually happen? And then, hang on, that was maybe like the Disney version cut that out. So was that actually in the Grimm version? So I actually went on Twitter and like, guys, what's going on with this story? Did I forget it? Like, did I forget the ending of it? And they were like, no, that's added into the park. And it's like, okay. Yeah, that's pretty creepy. And then as you're exiting the tunnel after all of that story, the swan head on the boat thing turns around and looks at you and is bleeding out of its eyes and stuff. So it's just, you know, it's psychological horror. No combat, just an experience. Like it's a theme park, kind of like it's like a haunted house kind of theme park ride. And it's really cool. I like it a lot.
Mm. Yeah.
On to more, I guess, conventional horror games. I mean, we can talk about stuff like the earlier Silent Hill games and all that kind of stuff. But is there anyone that, like, you can kind of think of, Alan, that really stands out for you?
Well, basically, as far as I'm concerned, at the moment, the horror game that sort of stood out the most for me has been Alien Isolation. That game is a wonderful, wonderful example of how to do modern horror correctly. It does go for a bit too long, but it is a very exciting game to play. It's one of those things that I, you know, will sit in my room at like 1 a.m. in the morning, just, you know, bash out for a couple of hours and just freak out constantly. So yeah, it's a very, very good horror game. It has the right amount of combat, it has the right amount of hiding, it has the right amount of survival aspects, which I think is all very important to being an intelligent survival horror game. It's very similar to Bloodborne, I guess, in that way, where you sort of have to manage everything and try and survive by the, you know, the back of your hair sort of thing. It's very, very exciting, very, very pleasing, and I quite like it. I don't like, however, is Outlast, because that game is very, very boring and very hide-and-seek. And I don't want to play hide-and-seek. I want to be scared.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a pretty good, interesting contrast between, if we're to contrast Outlast to Alien Isolation. Like, Alien Isolation is very much kind of stalker horror genre. You know, where you've got the one kind of monster that's kind of chasing you around, and you've got to try and figure out how to, you know, complete your objectives while not being killed by this thing. And it's really good because, amongst other things, it's very true to the atmosphere of the original Alien film. And, you know, it balances out everything quite well, like you said. Outlast, on the other hand, is also stalker horror in the sense that you are just trying to keep yourself alive while avoiding all these things. But it has such an overall reliance on jump scares. And jump scares, they're funny, like the first time you have one, because you jump, like it's involuntary.
And then you laugh afterwards, yeah.
Yeah, you jump because you have to. Like it's just that combination of loud noise and sudden movement and all that. It just naturally makes you kind of go, ah, you know. But after that first time, it's never actually scary. It's just a reaction. And then after the first one, you don't really have that reaction ever again. And it just becomes like increasingly dull the more they go through it and the more times they repeat that action. And all of Outlast is just these endless stream of jump scares. And yeah, it didn't work nearly as well as it, I don't think.
Yeah, I think the reason that Alien Isolation does it so well and that Outlast doesn't is that Outlast doesn't give you an opportunity to fight back. You can only run. And I feel like any good survival horror game, as a survival horror game, not as like a narrative horror game, does need some form of combat or way to defend yourself, because that's part of the sort of stress, I feel, of should I use this now and try and get out in a better way, or do I run and hide for a bit and try and get past without wasting any resources that I can use later? And that's one of the things with Outlast that really, really, I guess, it stuck with me with Outlast, because there's nothing that you can do. Like, absolutely nothing. There's hardly any player interaction. You go and hide in a cupboard for 20 minutes. It's the world's worst stealth game. It's not fun. It's boring.
Yeah.
And it sucks. And I'm being very sort of objective about this. And I apologize, but God, I hate Outlast.
Well, I mean, there are examples I can think of stalker horror games where you can't really fight back that are good. So to go back on the PlayStation 2, there were two that I really liked. One was Clock Tower 3, and the other was Haunting Ground.
Haunting Ground gives you some opportunity, though.
Well, Haunting Ground, you have the dog, Huey, who can kind of... You can tell him to go and, you know, fight off the monster temporarily. But really, I mean, the goal is to just run and hide or escape as often as you can until such a point as there's like, you know, the equivalent of like a boss battle where you actually get a chance to take the monster out of the picture for good.
Yeah, exactly. There is like an impetus that you're like moving towards getting rid of this monster. And Outlast doesn't really have that. Outlast just sort of makes you sit in a cupboard or under a bed. And I don't think that's very interesting, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't know if that's my issue with it. Another example is the Corpse Party series, which is, you know, very narrative-focused survival horror where, like, for the most part, you're also just running away from the monsters when they show up.
Really quick question, sorry. Is that the game that's done by the 999 team?
I have no idea. I know it's published by the same guys.
I'm probably thinking about that. Yeah, I'm thinking about that. Okay, cool.
It's published by Rising Star in Australia, which is the same ones. So, yeah, it is actually a really good horror game again, but it's all story-based, and it is just the description in that game, the description of what's going on is so vivid, it's like reading like a really explicit horror book, which is, you know, it's creepy and crawly and all that. But the point I'm making is that, like, those three games... For me, Clock Tower 3, Haunting Ground, and Corpse Party, they all kind of represent how stalker horror can be done in a way that you don't really have a fight back option through most of the experience. Again, what gets me with Outlast, I guess, is just the way it relies on jump scares, because none of those three games have jump scares. The monster shows up and you run like hell, but the monster doesn't jump through a window at you when you're like, you know, a couple of centimeters away.
Yeah, I get that.
And I mean, Outlast also doesn't actually have a story beyond the jump scares. Like, you're a journalist. Oh, it's kind of does, but it's like you're playing this journalist, you just kind of sneak into an asylum, and then, of course, because it's an asylum, stuff's happened.
It's something's gone horribly, horribly wrong, and then it suddenly turns out that Umbrella's involved, even though they're dead, and then Leon S. Kennedy has to come in, and he's kicking people in the face.
Yeah, it's just nonsense, you know? It's... The other, I like horror games when they have a story that's like interesting, and has some kind of meat beyond the scares, if that makes sense.
And it turns out that Jill's dead, but she's not dead, and then her hair color's changed.
Yeah.
I cannot ever not mock that. Anytime I don't understand you, Capcom. I really don't. She looked really cool before. Why would you change her? Jill, I love you.
So, yeah, I mean, I know there's an Outlast 2 coming. I hope they fix stuff.
Yeah.
All that. I mean, there's potential in the game. So all they really need to do is add a meaty story that's not generic, investigate a haunted house kind of thing. And they can do that with a halfway decent writer. And then just focus a little bit less of the jump scares.
More on procedural horror sort of thing.
Yeah. Keep people on their toes, but that doesn't mean that they need to, throw the controller on the ground. I don't know. Like get in the player's head more than, make them
more Silent Hill
fidgety. Yeah.
Just be silent. Every game should be Silent Hill 2.
Yeah.
No, not all even just horror, just all. Just all games just should be Silent Hill 2 and or 3 with a mix of Shattered Memories.
Yeah, those were good. Silent Hill used to be good. Because, Silent Hill got everything wrong about, like, action and all of that. Especially Silent Hill 1. 1 and 2 are basically unplayable now. But
I feel like if you go in with a mindset of understanding that that was what was done at the time, I think it's a lot easier to deal with. I played it a long time ago, it did a lot more. I'm more tolerant of its tank nonsense.
Well, I think people can get tolerant of it. I mean, obviously you can play it. When I say unplayable, I mean, relatively speaking. I don't mean it's actually unplayable, otherwise you wouldn't be able to finish the game. Obviously you can finish the game. So that's
you can cry a lot as well.
But it's not... I mean, nothing about that combat or action is why you're playing the game. You're playing the game for like a whole bunch of other reasons. And the main one is obviously the story. Like, it's a really good story.
It's genuinely like a fascinating narrative, and you don't see it very often in games, but I will go back and I'll like read bits of the script. And I performed a monologue, the initial monologue from James speaking in the bathroom with the I Got a Letter monologue.
Did you?
I performed that. And it was totally fine because no one was like, oh yeah, that's a very video gamey monologue. It was just, that's a cool monologue. Which,
yeah, I mean, the actual scripting of the game is just brilliant. It's very, like, the focus on themes around guilt and loss and all of that kind of stuff. It's very Japanese horror in the sense of it's not just about the fear, it's about the tragedy as well. And tragedy is a recurring theme through Japanese horror. And it's why I enjoy it a lot, because it has like something beyond the fear to really get you interested on both, I guess, the physical reaction level as well as the mental engagement.
I'd say it's the most mature game that's ever been made by far.
It's up there. I mean, even within just the horror genre, you've got stuff like the Project Zero 2.
I've heard that's really good.
It really is. It's very much in the same vein as Silent Hill. It's a very intelligent horror game that doesn't just rely on the scares, the fear. It has a really in-depth plot that you could take to your literature class at university and have a good discussion. Up there with any book that you might be reading. So, Fatal Frame, Project Zero, whatever it's called in your region, is another good example. If I'm thinking about horror games alone with smart plots,
I'd like to talk about Binding of Isaac quickly, even though it's not really got a set out narrative. It's quite interesting and very, it's got a lot going for it. And it's one of those things where if you just jumped on and touched the game for like half an hour, you wouldn't notice it. But if you do go down and you do sort of see all these different ideas that the game's pushing to you, it is actually quite intelligent and quite creepy. And I think it's very interesting. And if you do have the chance to sort of delve into that sort of wiki of Isaac, I would very much recommend it. It's a very, very cool little narrative. And I think understanding Ed McMillan's background as well is something that sort of adds on top of that.
Sure. Yeah, no, I can definitely get it. I mean,
I would recommend.
I mean, obviously, I haven't played it as much as you have, but I've played it enough, and I certainly, yeah, I get where it's coming from. I think it's a quality narrative as well.
Yeah, it's very much worthwhile. I very much enjoy it, and you can get it pretty cheap now. Like, you can get Rebirth, I think, on PS4, quite cheap.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's definitely worthwhile checking it.
Yeah, absolutely. One other one that I did want to mention, another horror game that I think is particularly smart, is Call of Cthulhu Dark Corners of the Earth, which is a fairly old game now. It was released on the Xbox 360, I want to say, or One. The original Xbox. The original Xbox. When I say one, I mean actually Xbox, the first one. And PC, it was a Bethesda game, like, from way back. And
yeah, it's the one, right?
It's based in almost entirely on the Shadow over Innsmouth, H.P. Yes. Lovecraft short story. And it is really good. I mean, Shadows over Innsmouth is probably my favorite Lovecraft short story. It's a very well-written, quite intense narrative, which kind of exposes all of Lovecraft's themes and sense of horror and all, so on and so forth. And the thing with Lovecraft is he's remarkably difficult to turn into any visual medium, whether it be that games, film, TV series, whatever, because Lovecraft's thing was that you can't actually see the monster. If you see them, all you see is the reaction that people have to the monster. Mm-hmm. So if somebody, you know, someone sees Cthulhu and you just get this very vague sense of what that creature is, and then the guy goes nuts. So what he saw drove him insane. And that's where the fear lies with Lovecraft. How you do that in a game is a very difficult thing. I think Bethesda, back with that game, did a particularly good job. I would like to see a HD remake of that one, actually.
Yeah, that's actually that's something that I always used to see, and I always used to be very like interested by what it was doing, because as a kid I was interested in like Lovecraft sort of stuff, because Cthulhu looked really cool. And that was pretty much my only motivation for doing that. But I always thought that Bloodborne actually does a really, really good job of sort of translating the Cthulhu mythos with the whole eyes on the inside idea.
Yeah, I would definitely say that there's some, I guess, kind of Lovecraft through Bloodborne. It's obviously not a Lovecraftian game.
Oh, yeah, it's not the entirely Lovecraft, but the eyes on the inside, the use of insight, I feel, is very interesting, because the more insight you have, the more that you see and the more insane things get. I really like that. That's absolutely brilliant. It's a very, very simple way of sort of translating a Cthulhu mythos, like a narrative device, into a game, I feel. Even if it is literally just a number that goes up whenever you kill something.
Like, yeah,
it's smart.
Yeah, the atmosphere as well kind of suits the Lovecraftian style. The Victorian horror match as well. I know Lovecraft wasn't writing Victorian horror stories, but they do marry up quite well together.
Yes, definitely.
And they do become to the point where, you know, it can be difficult to distinguish one from the other. I mean, the other example, just as a final one for Lovecraft, is the original Alone in the Dark, which was an explicit attempt to do Lovecraft in a video game. It's fairly difficult to play now for similar reasons that Silent Hill and whatever are. But again, it's quite smart. And that setting of, at least the original setting of being in like a small mansion in the dead of the night with lightning and water, rain and all that kind of stuff. And then these creatures jumping through the window and attacking you. That kind of stuff isn't done so often anymore. It's really cool. It makes thinking about now, I'd just love to see an Evil Dead game or something. Would be really
there fun. Actually was an Evil Dead game on the PS1.
I don't want to know about that.
It was Evil Dead Hail to the King, and it was awful.
Yeah, when I say I would like one, I'd like a good one.
Okay. but in all fairness, though, there was a button that would just make Ash say groovy. So,
well, that's a pretty good one.
That's a good button.
It's like the horror equivalent of the hug button from Boy Needs a Blob.
That is a good point. I would also like to point out, if you are at all interested in Alone in the Dark, ignore anything from the last 20 years.
Yeah, I would anything. I just miss everything that's not Alone in the Dark 1 or 2. The series went crazy after that and changed hands a few
times. I don't know if you played the remake.
No. No, I won't. It's owned by Atari now. And Atari
it is owned by Atari. Games. And I don't think they know what a game is.
No,
I'm pretty sure whoever designed Alone in the Dark didn't, like, what is it called? Alone in the Dark, like, it's in the light or something. I don't know. It's dumb. You're not alone. It's a co-op game.
Yeah.
You're not in the dark because you're always in the light because you're turning on lights.
Yeah, I would never touch that.
It's in the title. Like, you look, there's no source, but like, first thing you think of, it's Alone in the Dark. Okay, I'm going to be alone, it's in the dark. What do you do? I'm going to make a cop shooter game that's in the light.
Yeah, I know.
I'm so mad.
One other one I would like to mention just quickly in terms of upcoming horror games that would be worth looking at, especially given that we're, you know, the films that we've been talking about. There is a game which was originally going to be a Friday the 13th game. I don't think it is anymore. I think it's been renamed or something. But it's basically about that whole bunch of teenagers go to a cabin in the woods a monster kind of pops out and starts chasing them around, Jason Voorhees.
That's the 4v1 multiplayer one, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Two games coming up. So the one that you're thinking of is done by it's not Splash Damage, but they released a shooter in the mid sort of PS3 era. And it didn't sell particularly well, but then they started making a 4v1 horror game that's procedurally generated, which is exactly what you're talking about. And you just have to run and escape if you're playing as the teenagers, or, you know, you're playing as the boogeyman, or you're playing as Pyramid Head or whatever, even though he's playing Pachinko now. There is that game, and there's also the officially licensed Friday the 13th game, which...
Oh, there is still one coming, is there?
That, I almost kickstarted that, but it was very expensive. It's got a score done by Henry Mancini, which I don't know if anyone on this podcast sort of cares about that, but I very much do, because Mancini is a god. And it's being looked over by the original director of the first Friday the 13th.
Sean Cunningham?
That guy, yes.
Nice.
I'm so keen. It's what you've always sort of wanted, because as a kid, you know, like, oh, I'm going to play like the cop of the role or that sort of thing. Except now you're playing as Jason Voorhees or teenagers. What's not to like?
I didn't even realize that game was still happening as an actual Friday the 13th game. That's cool. I like that.
It's wonderful. And like I said, because they've got Mancini on board, it's going to feel like a Friday the 13th.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's really cool.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, that's good stuff. All right. That's on the list of games to play.
Yeah.
Is that coming out this year?
I don't think it's coming out this year. I think it's maybe like next year, Q1 maybe or something.
Oh, good.
Don't hold me on that, though, because I'm probably wrong. It's Kickstarter, so, like, anything can happen.
Yeah.
I feel like if they've got Mancini on board, if they've got the director on board, it's not going to be a Mighty Number 9 situation. Thank God.
No, it'll probably come. That's good. Excellent. Yeah. Game of the Year 2017.
Yeah. No. Doom. Game of the Year 2017. Right.
I'm not mentioning that one anymore, remember?
For the game which must not be named.
Yeah, that's it. It's the game I'm not mentioning ever again. It's Voldemort and I'm Harry Potter.
Yes.
I'm going to zap it.
Yes. You're going to have like a very epic fight. I'm going to Photoshop a picture of just the Doom box art and then your me avatar and just put that as the title for this podcast.
Okay. Just get my new chief. They look the same.
Brilliant. That's my plan done.
All right. I think we've gone way over time this week. Thank you for listening to our insane ramblings. It was pretty good fun, though. We like talking about horror games. Yeah, next week we'll be back to talking about stuff that isn't related to first-person shooters or horror, we promise. So, yes, you can catch us on our social medias, and they will be up there on the podcast website. You can grab them there, and you can pester us about the horror games that we missed that you liked, and no doubt you're going to be angry at us for not mentioning those. just kidding, Chris. All right, so thank you very much for listening. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week, and catch you later.
Digitally uploaded.